So this week we're going to come to a subject that's sort of half negative apologetics and half positive apologetics. We're not simply going to beat up on Darwinism, although we will, and it's good fun and it needs to be done. We're going to try to explore an alternative model for understanding nature, particularly biology. Now, we've already run across this when we looked at the cosmic constants, right? The strong anthropic principle. And all these features of the universe that are finely tuned for human life. That's at the macro level. But we're going to look more today at the micro level, a very small, very complex, information-rich systems, and ask what the best explanation for these systems are. Now, Darwinism is a potential defeater of the Christian worldview. But before we get to that, we've got to talk a little bit about Christianity and scientific claims and the nature of theories in science and certain objections to using intelligence or using God as an explanation for nature. The way it's been set up, and we receive certain sensibilities, we receive certain traditions, they're sort of in the cultural DNA. They're taken for granted. And let me give an example of this. Did any of you read this National Geographic, Was Darwin Wrong? How many of you read that? You should all take a look at that. At least five of you have read it. It's a perfect propaganda piece for Darwinism. And there's a particular template that's set up. I don't have time to read very much of it, but let me, if I can find it. Let me just read you how this is set up, just in the first paragraph or so, assuming I can read it. Evolution by natural selection, the central concept of the life work of Charles Darwin, is a theory. It's a theory about the origin of adaptation, complexity, and diversity among Earth's living creatures. If you are skeptical by nature, unfamiliar with the terminology of science, and unaware of the overwhelming evidence, you might well be tempted to say that it's just a theory. In the same sense, relativity is described by Einstein as just a theory. The notion that the Earth orbits around the Sun, rather than vice versa, offered by Copernicus in 1543, is a theory. Continental drift is a theory. The existence, structure, and dynamics of atoms, atomic theory, even electricity, is a theoretical construct involving electrons, which are tiny units of charged mass that no one has ever seen. Each of these theories is an explanation that has been confirmed to such a degree by observation and experience that knowledgeable experts accept it as a fact. That's what scientists mean when they talk about a theory, not a dreamy and unreliable speculation, but an explanatory statement that fits the evidence. They embrace such an explanation confidently but provisionally, taking it as their best available view of reality, at least until some severely conflicting data or some better explanation might come along. That, in fact, is false for the vast majority of the Darwinists in the United States and the Western world. They have set it up such that it is unfalsifiable. You'll see that in a moment. But then they ponder, why is it that about 40-45% of Americans still buy creation of some kind and not Darwinian evolution? Why are there so many anti-evolutionists? Scriptural literalism can only be part of the answer. The American public certainly includes a large segment of scriptural literalists, but not that large, not 44%. Creationist proselytizers, notice the language. Scientists are objective, rational. Creationists are proselytizers. And political activists working hard to interfere with the teaching of evolutionary biology in public schools are another part. Listen to that language. All that has ever been argued for, whether it's the older creationism, and those cases were shot down in the 80s, or the newer intelligent design theory, is not interference, it's equal time. In fact, many times the intelligent design people are only arguing for a critique of Darwinism. They're not even arguing for their positive program to be put in place. Think of the power of the gatekeepers in our society, the person who wrote this article. Honest confusion and ignorance among millions of adult Americans must be still another. Many people have never taken a biology course. that dealt with evolution, nor read a book in which the theory was lucidly explained. Sure, we've all heard of Charles Darwin and of a vague, somber notion about the struggle and survival that sometimes goes by the catch-all label Darwinism. But the main sources of information from which most Americans have drawn their awareness of this subject, it seems, are haphazard ones at best. Cultural osmosis, newspaper and magazine references, half-baked nature documentaries on the tube, and hearsay. Evolution is both a beautiful concept and an important one. More crucial nowadays to human welfare, to medical science, and to our understanding of the world than ever before. It is also deeply persuasive, a theory you can take to the bank. All right. You know, I read this and I was still convinced Darwinism was false. And I have read entire books lucidly explaining and arguing for Darwinism, and I still think Darwinism is false. And I didn't get my PhD from Podunk Bible Academy either. So the way this is set up, this is very important to what we're going to talk about tonight. We've got to look at evidence and argument and the philosophy of science. But you have to understand we're talking about rival sources of authority. People view science as a kind of monolithic authority. Now, that's been broken down a little bit by postmodern non-realism. Well, even the scientists don't really have the final answer. And in that respect, that approach can possibly loosen people up to other sources of truth, unless they get rid of the idea of truth entirely, and then we're completely in the swamp. But a lot of people still think that somehow the deliverances of quote-unquote science, with a capital S, are rational, reliable, or true, and religion is the realm of subjectivity and opinion, largely. But interestingly, this movie I saw last night was trying to use avant-garde theories about quantum physics to defend pantheistic monism. Now, that's interesting. And they've been doing that for a good 30 years. It started out with the Tao of Physics back in the 70s. I believe it was 1975. What is his name? Capra, Fritjof Capra's book, The Tao of Physics. It's the idea that somehow science has to authenticate religion because science is more authoritative, objective, rational than religion. So if science can authenticate religion, religion can now be at the banquet table of intellectual culture. But oftentimes they are pitted against each other. And how many times have you heard, and have I heard, a story on National Public Radio or a newspaper story or National Geographic that basically says, and they say this in the editorial, I won't read it, religion is fine. We have freedom of religion in the United States. But leave the science to the Darwinists. Now, translated, that means leave the science to the naturalists, the materialists, the physicalists, who will not allow any aspect of theism to inform their theorizing, or they will not allow it into their evidence. Period. So again, what our net doesn't catch ain't fish. Now, that is defined as science, methodological naturalism. Now, if methodological naturalism is the only game in town, is it any wonder that Darwinism always trumps the opposition? Because if the opposition is something having to do with an intelligence outside of nature informing the structures of nature, that is what? Unscientific, supposedly. Now, the genius of Philip Johnson, who's right at the fountainhead of the intelligent design movement, is that as a law professor at UC Berkeley, he is an expert on the use of evidence and argument. And one summer, he read a critique of evolution, Evolution, a Theory in Crisis, by Denton, and he read a pro-evolution book, The Blind Watchmaker, by Dawkins. He read both books and he said, the theory of evolution has nothing going for it evidentially. Why in the world has it taken over the world? And what he came up with was ingenious. It was this. The Darwinists are presuppositionally committed to methodological naturalism. If you do that, you have just banished for all time any possible evidence to the contrary. if you open up the definition and understanding of science to admit the possibility that intelligence has informed the structure and nature of life, it's an entirely different ballgame. I hope you've seen in this class that recognizing presuppositions, recognizing worldviews is paramount. Now, the way the Darwinists want to make peace with the religious people, or basically keep them on the plantation, keep them at the back of the bus, is to say, look, you have your personal, private, subjective faith. That's fine. That's the realm of values. Leave the facts to us. Okay? So you can have your mythologies. You can have an hour on Sunday morning, but we design the biology curriculum for all the public schools, and you cannot have a critique of Darwinism. If we allow you to have a critique of Darwinism, we'll have to allow the flat earthers in. Boy, this language is often used. And don't you people realize you lost at the Scopes trial a long time ago? And don't you people realize that science has been beating religion consistently in truth claims for about 300 or 400 years? All this goes into the cultural DNA of Western society, particularly American culture. Now, it's odd. We are very religious people. About 90% believe in God or a higher power. Yet the elites in our culture are committed to a thoroughly materialistic worldview. I mean education and media, by and large. Committed to a materialistic view of the universe. And religion is the realm of values and subjectivity, not the world of empirical evidence or scientific theory. Okay? That's the setup. So in order to deal with this, we have to not only question some of the evidential support for Darwinism and present an alternative model for science that allows design to appear if it's there, we have to look a little bit at the philosophy of science and also at what the Bible itself commits us to believe about the origin of the earth and the origin of species. So the way oftentimes this has been done previously with some of the old creation scientist people, and they've done a lot of good work, especially on negative apologetics, has been to critique the Darwinists, that Darwinism has tremendous difficulties with the fossil record, that Darwinism cannot explain certain structures in living organisms, and so on. And those are very good points. But we have to kind of pull back a little bit and talk about the nature of the philosophy of science in relation to the claims of Scripture. And keep in mind the dynamics of the cultural debate. Because the way it is set up, the gatekeepers pretty much control how the word will get out. And I gave you some examples from this article. Creationist proselytizers. And then you have the nice, neat, wonderful, logical people in the white coats who only see facts and verify theories. And you would think from this article that atomic theory, that rather Darwinian theory was just as well established as atomic theory or electrical theory. By no means is it. Or it's just as well established as heliocentrism. By no means is it. But that is in the cultural DNA, and that sets the template for the culture. Now, the film we'll be seeing in not too long from now will show you something about something called the intelligent design movement. Now, Darwin, from day one, has been criticized on scientific grounds. And that said scientific. The way this is set up in the cultural discourse with respect to the thought forms is science is naturalistic. Science is about material objects and their relationship and fields of force. And religion is about values. So if you're going to attack Darwinism, the only possible resource is a sacred book or a personal revelation. And the way our society is set up, science always silences Scripture and personal revelation, at least in terms of the structures of authority in our culture. I'm speaking descriptively now, okay? What is not allowed by many people is for someone to critique the assumptions and the evidence of Darwinism on scientific grounds, using principles of intelligence detection, which is what the genius of the intelligent design brings to the table. In many ways, Johnson was sort of the forefather. He He did a lot of great negative apologetics against Darwinism. He's not a scientist. He's not a philosopher of scientists, per se. He's a law professor who found this as an avocation. But we have also people like people you'll see in the film. Bill Dembski, Michael Behe, and others, Stephen Mayer, who are very well skilled in these disciplines, philosophy of science. Behe himself is a biochemist. And they are not only critiquing Darwinism, they're trying to come up with a new model or a new paradigm of detecting design in nature that does not say there must be design in nature because the Bible says so, that does not appeal to the Bible. And the intelligent design movement is not worried about the age of the earth kinds of questions, the extent of the Noah's flood. And this is to the genius, really, of Philip Johnson. He said, we need a big tent approach to dethroning Darwinism. In fact, there are people in the intelligent design movement who are not Christians. One of the people you'll see in this film, a brilliant critic of Darwinism, Jonathan Wells, is a Mooney. He's a member of the Unification Church. Fine. When you're dealing with cultural warfare, you have to have a big tent. Right? You have to work with people that Schaefer used to call co-belligerents. It means there are people that agree with you on important things. They also disagree with you on important things. Where they agree with you, you make common cause with them. Where you disagree with them, you oppose them. I review Jonathan Wells' tremendous book, Icons of Evolution, in Moody Magazine and praised it to the hilt. But I also told people, I believe I told people in there, that he's not a Christian. But a lot of my work as a Christian worker, as an apologist, has been against cults and against religions, and I've argued a lot against Moody's for their false doctrines. But you see, Wells is very good against Darwin. He's very bad on the rest of his theology. So you have people that are not Christians, Roman Catholics. Behe is a Roman Catholic. I'm not saying he's not a Christian, but it's broader than just evangelical Christians. There are skeptics like David Berlinski. I don't know where he stands on this. He's not in this particular film tonight. So it's a big tent approach, and something that's very important about this approach is that it's not overtly apologetic. It is indirectly apologetic. The goal of the intelligent design movement is to reestablish the category of design as a legitimate explanatory category in science. That's all it is. And that is a tremendous challenge. So you cast a broad net, you have a big tent. And this movement has developed in the last 10 to 15 years through books, through journals, through websites, through various seminars around the country, through the work of people like Bill Dembski. Dembski was at Baylor for 5 years. They were stupid enough to let him go. He's now going to be at a seminary, Southern Baptist Seminary. I forgot which one. It's too bad. You really need Bill Dembski at a major research institution, not a seminary. Because most of the time, seminaries don't even take the humanities all that seriously. But anyway, Dembski's one of the leading lights of this movement. Speaks all over the country. Very productive. The guy has got a PhD in mathematics and a PhD in philosophy and an MDiv in theology. Very, very bright. And they are making an impact, as we'll see in this film. They are making an impact. It's a different type of strategy. It is not overtly apologetic. It is basically trying to reintroduce design into the world of scientific explanation using bona fide rational principles for which you do not have to overtly appeal to the Bible. Okay? Now look, if we believe in general revelation and if we believe in natural theology, there's a whole sphere of possible evidences and arguments out there. Now they agree with the Bible. God is the designer. But the intelligent design is not going for the home run, so to speak. They're basically going for a single or a double. Get design back on the field. Because it has been eradicated through Darwinism in the last 100 and 120 years. And is part of the cultural DNA. So we need some genetic surgery to get it out of the DNA. Or at least open the DNA up again to other information. All right, questions or comments so far about what I'm talking about? Yes?
Yeah, in your opinion, what has created this disparity or polarization between theism and Darwinism, mostly throughout the last 100 years, is it? Atheistic creatures that are running out the mouth and make terrible comments like Falwell, maybe you're a Deuce Wagner.
Right.
Those are media kind of.
Oh, they love those images, sure.
Right, and you never see any intelligence behind them. So I would guess mass media like that.
Oh, the Scopes trial was a huge turning point in the United States. Nancy Piercy has written on that. Philip Johnson has written on that. The Scopes trial basically made the creationists look stupid. And there was a movie called Inherit the Wind that has propagated that for decades. That stereotype that anyone who challenges Darwinism is a know-nothing, is an ignoramus, is somehow sinister, a threat to science, a threat to civilization. Really. And they can preach this stuff on Sundays if they want, but don't you dare let them in the citadels of power, namely the public schools. The public schools in the United States, we have compulsory education, you might know. And when you have compulsory education and the curriculum comes from the top down, it by and large determines the contours of a culture. In many ways it does. And of course you have other institutions. But it forms sort of the infrastructure of the culture. And the people that go to the most prestigious schools tend to go into what? Politics and media. And they control the rest of it. So it's very significant that this movement is coming from largely scientists and philosophers of science and not preachers and not seminary professors. Because people like that in some ways are at a disadvantage unless they really know their stuff. So it's a perception propagated through media. Now, some people have made their peace with evolution. They're theistic evolutionists. Now, I think that view is both unscientific and unbiblical. But there are many people who have made their peace with it, and they think somehow that God guided the process. Now, an unpleasant detail here is that Darwin and his predecessors, he didn't make up the thing from scratch. He came up with natural selection just barely in front of Wallace. They found out that Wallace was working on it, so he quickly wrote his book to get the idea out before Wallace. 490-page book. It was just his abstract, supposedly. Origin of Species. Darwin was severely bothered by the cruelty and waste in nature. And during his day, the apologists of the day were very much propagating the argument from design and saying that nature was perfect. Look at the perfection of nature. Darwin looked at things like parasites and the tremendous waste of pollen. And he said, how could there be a good God in charge of this kind of a system? So at the root of what Darwin did was a theological, metaphysical perspective that God could not be directly responsible for the way the world is. And so he wanted to basically exempt God from the process. He was a Christian for a time. He left the faith. Part of it had to do with the death of his daughter, which he never recovered from. His wife was a believing Christian to the end, I believe. He junked Christianity, became something of a deist or agnostic. But the whole notion of natural selection is that God has nothing to do with speciation. Nothing. There's natural law. There's matter. And there's time, and there's chance. God is not directly guiding anything. Now, he did make a few comments about God might have created the first few forms. But he never developed that idea. And we'll see this in the movie. He talked about a primordial pond that might have been the location of the first life. Darwin's big chops were on what happens after life is already there. He said almost nothing about the origin of life. And that's one of the tremendous weaknesses in naturalistic accounts of life, is the origin of life. Just bracket speciation for a minute. The first life, whatever it is, how does it come out of non-life? How does information come out of non-information? Let's see. So that's a huge cultural, historical story to tell. But the lay of the land right now is pretty much the gatekeepers of the culture have told us that Darwinism or something like it is the only rational option. We can keep the religious people around so long as they don't horn in on that territory. What the intelligent design people are saying is, you don't have the arguments. You are supported more by a plausibility structure than you are by a rational system of argument. Remember we made that distinction in this class repeatedly? Plausibility structures and rationality. A plausibility structure supports ideas whether they're rational or irrational. I mean, how many of you in your apologetic interviews would give a presentation on Christianity or an argument and the person would tell you what? I never heard this before. And when they hear it, oftentimes they're interested in it. But they don't hear it from Dan Rather. They don't find it from Hollywood. They don't get it in their undergraduate degree at a secular school. They don't get it from the pulpit or the Christian ed classes. They don't get it from the op-ed pieces in the newspapers. See? You don't even get it in the church half the time, apologetics and critiques of naturalism and so on. So it's a long story, but here we are. What do we do about it? Now, we need to spend a little bit of time on theories and the nature of science. Don't worry too much about debates on the nature of science, the realism, non-realism debate. Of course, the postmodernists are telling us that there is no truth. There is no way at getting at the way the world is. But I think that most scientists that are all motivated think they have at least a shot at getting at the way the world is. Certainly this article, was Darwin wrong? And the first page of the article says, in big letters, no. And by the way, this article makes no reference to any of the arguments you'll see in this film. None whatsoever. It's called Argument by Exclusion. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah, it's almost impossible. Now, Bill Dembski got his thesis through, which became a book for Cambridge University Press, The Design Inference. That's rare. You have to be pretty much a genius and a political genius to pull that off. But in terms of getting into graduate schools, getting a teaching position, winning tenure, you won't do it if you're an outspoken critic of Darwinism. The time to do that is after tenure. That's just the lay of the land. And you talk about research money. One of the reasons why the intelligent design movement is a movement at all is because of a particular Christian millionaire named Howard Amundsen, who has something called the Fieldsted Institute. The Fieldsted Institute has bankrolled a lot of the big conferences and gives a lot of money to the Discovery Institute in Seattle, Washington. Howard Amundsen is a Christian philanthropist. He has funded me in the past for a few projects, little tiny projects. The guy's got a huge amount of money, and he knows what's important. Without Howard and some other people like him, you wouldn't see as much of a movement. You need money to propagate important ideas in our culture. To some degree, you need money. If you want to change the structure of the culture, if you want to challenge the received orthodoxies, and don't expect the government to give you any grant to study intelligent design. Why? They'll invoke the separation of church and state. We can't fund that. That's religion. So you have to find the funding through private means. You have to be creative. Yeah. Right. Right. Exactly. Yeah, you have to be able to work at the highest theoretical level to win over the respect of the intellectuals, and Behe and Dembski and Stephen Mayer are doing that. I put in your outline, I think this is the first Referee Journal article defending design with respect to DNA. It was published by Stephen Mayer this year. Do you all know what a referee journal is? A referee journal is a professional academic journal. You send in a paper, they give it to two or three referees. And if they like it, they will publish it or they may have you revise it. That is the gold standard for the academic world. How many referee journal articles do you have? How many does your intellectual movement have, your institution have? See, this is probably the first one. Now, of course, it's a catch-22 because the Darwinists say, well, you don't have really many academic journal articles to speak of. So it can't be a legitimate movement. Well, they just trash most of them. You know, so they have won the situation without a contest. But Mayer is quite brilliant, and he got this in there. And that's a step. So you've got to work at the highest intellectual levels. You have to work at the intermediary level to get the word out to thinking people who may not be practicing scientists or philosophers of science. And then you also need kind of more of a popular approach that you might be able to get into a contemporary magazine or in a more popular book, or actually in film, such as we're seeing. This film is by no means a dumbed-down film. You've got to think about this film. You know, I said, watching a video and thinking, it's a novel idea. But it is possible. And this video encourages you to do so. So you need to have at least three prongs of your strategy. Yeah, Nick?
On that popular and intermediate level, most of the magazines you read have they're almost like a billboard for Darwinism. I remember, I guess, Scientific American.
Oh, yeah.
And there was actually a letter from the editor, I think it's about 4 years ago, and the title of the article from the editor was In Science We Trust. And it was just a one-page, basically a polemic against any kind of a design, anything that would infer a God at all.
Right.
And people read that stuff and they think that that's the normal, logical, reasonable thing to believe because these people propagate that in the kind of a pop science magazine.
Right, again, they're gatekeepers. And Stephen Jay Gould trashed Philip Johnson's book, Darwin on Trial. A lot of it was just cheap shots. And they would not let Johnson respond. They wouldn't publish it. They would not publish a response. Well, you see, the gatekeepers have the power to some degree, control the ideas. So you have to keep working at different levels to get the ideas out there. Now, we're kind of getting ahead of ourselves. We haven't even given the critique, really. But a lot of what's going on happens at this worldview level, the methodological naturalism. And I think I've talked about this before, but methodological naturalism is not a neutral, fair approach. It says we're going to bracket the idea of whether there's a supernatural. Maybe yes, maybe no. We can't say. Who knows? However, it is not neutral because it's saying that if there is a supernatural, we're not going to allow anyone to detect it. Right? That is not neutral. That is not fair. You're saying if there is a supernatural that has an impact on the structures of this world, our science can say nothing about it. That is not being fair and open to everyone. That is eliminating the possibility of a theistic explanation. A priori, presuppositionally, it is not fair. It begs the question as to whether or not intelligence is a better explanation for some of the features of life. Yes.
One of the most poignant quotes I heard a number of years ago, particularly by James Kennedy in one of his sermons, Sir Julian Huxley, I guess he was the last generation's Darwin. He was asked on Nick had a show, some talk show, back in the 70s, why was the theory of Darwinism so rapidly spreading throughout the world? The idea of God interferes with our sexual mores, and that was his reason for the veracity of the theory.
Yeah, there's a powerful argument. Now, I'm not sure that's the right source. Aldous Huxley said that in a book called Means and Ends, or Ends and Means. I quoted it in an article I handed out earlier. He said basically, we didn't want the world to have meaning, because if it had meaning, then we couldn't do what we wanted to sexually. That might be the quote. Sometimes people will tip their hand. I mean, there's a quote by Richard Lewontin in the New York Times Review of Books. He was reviewing Carl Sagan's book, I think it's called Billions of Demons. And he said, basically, it doesn't matter how bizarre our naturalistic explanations look. It doesn't matter that they look like just so stories. He said, we have a presuppositional commitment to materialism, and we cannot let a divine foot in the door. You'll find that all over the Internet, on creationist websites, intelligent design websites. Okay, if that's how you play, then we lose. Heads, you win, and tails, we lose. It doesn't matter how ridiculous, how improbable, how bizarre the naturalistic explanation is, it must win. Why? Because the alternative is theism, and supposedly, theism destroys science and rationality. And what the intelligent design people are showing is, no, in fact, you become irrational if you deny intelligence as an explanation for certain features of life. It is counterintuitive. Let me give you an example of this. In terms of the bacterial flagellum. And you know what I'm talking about, but I've done this in a talk before. I just described something. Consider this object. It has a universal joint, a propeller, a drive shaft, a motor, bushings, or is it brushings? Bushings? Bushings, I'm a mechanic, you can tell, all of which are needed for its function, none of which are expendable. Is this a new motor for a boat or a car or an airplane? What is this? Well, you're looking under a high-powered microscope, and it's not something built by humans. Now, see, you can sort of trick people. Well, of course, if it has all these features, a universal joint, a propeller, drive shaft, motor, bushings, all of which are needed for its function, none of which are expendable, irreducible complexity, that's got to be something built by someone. Intelligence to fit it all together to have its function. But no, you're looking under a microscope. Oh, well, then it's a result of evolution. That's how it works. That's how the game is played. Now, we've got to talk a little bit about the limits of science and scientism, very briefly. Some people will argue that the only things that are knowable through science. So we have basic logical truths, definitional truths, bachelors are unmarried males, triangle has three sides, etc. And we have things that we can observe directly or indirectly. That's all we can know. That's called scientism. Now, there's strong and weak versions of it. But what is the important thing to remember about scientism? All we can know is what's derivable through science or through definitional types of truths, analytical truths. What's wrong with that? It's self-refuting. Because that statement itself is not true by definition. It's not an analytical truth. And it's not something you can observe directly or indirectly. It's too narrow as a criterion for truth. Moreover, there are a lot of counterexamples. There are things we know that we don't know in those two ways. We know certain truths of art, certain truths of beauty, maybe certain moral intuitions. We don't know as analytical truths, and we don't know as observational truths. So we can marshal counterexamples, and we can argue that it's self-refuting. Moreover, science itself is not the only way to know reality. There are limitations to science. It's one means of knowing. It's not the only means of knowing. And in fact, it can be trumped. You can find quotes from people like Steven Pinker and others who are dyed-in-the-wool physicalists. And they say, we are nothing but machines. Or Richard Dawkins, we're gene machines, basically. And so we have no free will, and we really have no agency, because we are controlled entirely by things outside of ourselves. But then Pinker says, well, when you start talking about morality, you just have to pretend as if that were not true. Well, that shows there's something wrong with his worldview, right? We can say, look, science is part of the explanation, but we also have an immaterial soul, which is why we have agency, which is why we are responsible agents. Last night in this ridiculous film I was watching, somebody says, you can go into the human mind and look, or the human brain, and look at every part of the human brain, and you can't find an observer in the material aspect of the person. Of course you can. The observer, the locus of consciousness, is not the brain, it's the mind, and that's not a physical thing. Now, of course, they didn't take it in the theistic direction. They were taking it in the pantheistic direction. But science is limited in what it discerns about reality. Moreover, there are presuppositions to science that are not a part of science itself, right? Like what? JP goes through several of these. Presuppositions for scientific discovery that are not a part of the deliverances of science itself. Paul? Right, the uniformity of nature, that nature is trustworthy. If a law obtains like this in this part of the world, it'll obtain in the same way under certain similar conditions elsewhere. That's really more of a presupposition than it's something you can establish empirically. Yeah? Sure. Not fudging your data. Not cherry-picking data, sharing findings wisely. Those are moral principles. They're not physical descriptions. That there's such a thing as truth, that the mind relates truthfully at times through the proper method to external objects. Okay? That in itself shows that science is not sort of an island unto itself. It's dependent on particular perspectives and values that are equally legitimate. And moreover, in many cases, moral intuitions can trump scientific claims. Steven Pinker several years ago was reflecting on this young woman who was pregnant at her prom, her senior prom, and she gave birth to a baby and killed it and put it in a garbage can and then finished the prom. And he was writing in the New York Times Review of Books, and he said, well, you know, I don't condone this, obviously, but we have to realize, he's an evolutionary psychologist, that things like this happen in the animal world all the time. And so we should not view this as murder. Now, I think most people who are at least sentient, who are reading that, are realizing that he has no argument. You simply have a moral intuition that this is murder. And it doesn't matter what some self-appointed scientific authority says about it. So science does not own the game of reality. It is important and significant. But when someone tries to put you into a box and says, unless you can prove it scientifically, I can't believe it, you should know what to do. J.P. Moreland has a great story on one of his tapes. Actually, I think it's also in his book, Love Your God With All Your Mind, where he was at some kind of an informal party, and he was dealing with a science professor who had never met a thoughtful Christian before. This is already sounding good, isn't it? And the guy gave J.P. Do you know J.P. Moreland? Have you met him? Have you heard him give lectures? He's a very super bright guy, as you might guess from his book. He's a pretty intense guy, too. He doesn't kid around. There's no garbage with J.P. No fluff, no wasted words, no spin, no schlock. I mean, he's a kingdom guy, all right? So he was talking to this guy, and he was some hoity-toity science professor who was a hardcore scientism follower, right? The only things you can know are through science. And J.P. Moreland basically gave the argument I just gave you, except probably a lot better. And he reduced the guy to silence within about 5 minutes. I wish I could have been there. And that's what we need to do with people. Now, he didn't do it to be cruel, but he just said, look, you can't support what you're saying. It contradicts itself. And the guy had no response. Why? He was living off of cultural capital. He was living off the plausibility structure. He had never run into a philosophically trained Christian before who knew a lick about the philosophy of science. So he could what? Bully people. Bully his students. Bully colleagues. But he ran into a thoughtful Christian. I met a guy a couple months ago who said, I like to view myself as the thoughtful Christian you've never met. That's sort of his ministry in life. To be the thoughtful Christian that the non-Christians never met. And I hope you'll have that ministry as well. Whether it's in the classroom, or in the pulpit, or overseas, or in journalism, or wherever it is. You don't let people get away with this crap. Okay? A little strong language there, sorry. But that's what it is. I could use stronger language. Get into even more trouble. All right, how do we integrate science and theology? Now, that's a huge subject, but I'm actually going to deal with it quite briefly. Cut right to the chase. You remember where in class several times I've said if you're going to do apologetics and believe it's important, you live dangerously? Basically, you say, this is true. It's not just true for me, subjectively true. It's pertinent. It counts. It means something forever, the Christian worldview. And I'm going to try to present it thoughtfully and rationally in the world of ideas and give people a chance to refute me. That's living dangerously. Right? Now, I don't mean that you should go out there and be terrified that you're not going to have answers. You know, you should be terrified that you betray the cause of Christ or that you say something ridiculous. I mean, that should send you back to the woodshed. I'm not saying this. It's dangerous like going out in Oregon without suntan lotion on all the time. I mean, that's just stupid. Right? That's living dangerously. It's like you're a melanoma lover, you know? That's just stupid. Doing apologetics is not stupid. In fact, it's commanded by the Bible, as we've talked about. But if you're going to do it, you have to live dangerously. Now, there are ways of viewing science and the claims of the Bible such that they never really come into any possible conflict. And J.P. Moreland goes through the various models that people have set up. Now, if you set it up such that science says nothing that can critique Christianity, neither can it say anything to support it. Now, the way to live dangerously, and I think to have a unified field of knowledge, so to speak, is to have an integrative model of science and the claims of biblical revelation. That is, they can mutually inform each other. And the leaders of the scientific revolution in Europe, 17th and 18th century, talked about the book of nature written by God and the book of scripture written by God. Now, if it's the same author who's all-knowing, all-powerful, and all-good, these books will not contradict each other. So you've got to look at nature as the book of God and Scripture as the book of God. One propositional, one non-propositional, but understandable by human minds created in the image and likeness of God. And we are to have dominion over the creation, to understand the nature of creation. That's part of our task as human beings. It's a scientific task. That's part of it. So an integrative model says that, sure, scientific investigation will not cover every aspect of theology. It doesn't cover, let's say, the nature of angels. We know that from Revelation. And angels are typically undetectable, and you can't set up a repeatable experiment to sort of capture an angel and find out what properties the angel has. That doesn't mean there are no such thing as angels or that believing in angels is irrational. But an angel is not a scientifically observable entity. Okay? But there are areas where there's a possible conflict between the claims in science and the claims of Revelation. Okay? Give me some possible conflicts. Because they're talking about what? The same subject matter. Well, certainly this one. Is there intelligence behind the origin of life and the difference between species? Or is it all a result of time and space and chance, as Schaeffer used to put it? That's a real conflict. Now, the way some people want to deal with it is to say, it's no conflict because the Bible doesn't speak to it. The Bible speaks to who, not how, and not when. Well, I think it does speak to how in the sense that God initiated, God intervened. So you can just try to set it up so there's no possible conflict. If there's no possible conflict, there's no possible support from science either. An interactive model says that something out there in the scientific world could be a challenge to what the Bible teaches. And moreover, the Bible might lead us to be suspicious of certain claims made in the realm of science. There's an interaction, a kind of dialogue. Book of nature, book of scripture, written by the same author. We try to see how they relate coherently, harmoniously. Yeah?
Say another conflict is natural selection and evolution don't explain why we have apparently evolved far beyond what is required to nearly survive, especially as human beings.
Well, sure, that's part of the argument. I mean, that's getting into a critique of Darwinism. And the fact that you can have a critique of it that at least indirectly serves a biblical purpose shows that there is overlap here. And, of course, you can critique Darwinism without directly appealing to the Bible, but still in service of defending the Bible. That's what just throws off a lot of people, a lot of the Darwinists. They think if something's in the Bible, there could be no possible scientific evidence for it. Well, who set that up? I mean, you just assume that? That's begging the question. Maybe there's some scientific evidence for some of the claims in the Bible. Would you at least look at them? You see, if you just read them out a priori, of course, you won't see them. You'll just dismiss them. It drives me bonkers when these ACLU people say things like, well, we can't have anything that's religious in the public schools. You know, we can't teach anything religious. Well, what about thou shalt not murder? That's right there in the Bible. But do you have to be a Christian to know it or believe it? No. Our culture is profoundly confused about matters of church and state. We've got better documents to work with than any other country in the world, but we're still profoundly confused about this. Yes?
You know, that verse you read at the beginning is really an interesting one because until we got into the intelligent design stuff in DNA, you couldn't understand it in that concept, but it's in conflict with evolutionary thought. And that's all flesh is the same flesh, whether it's flesh of flesh of fish, flesh of birds.
Yep.
And, you know, we know now that that is not true, and it's in agreement.
Yeah, there's nothing against what we know about the difference in the DNA codes. And see, the Darwinian picture is that we all have a common ancestor, and it's this great continuity. So Darwinists are always hacking away at, just notice this, you probably notice this, they're always hacking away at the supposed differences between humans and animals. Oh, we're not unique in having language. You know, dolphins have language. We've trained apes to develop, you know, this vocabulary, which includes things like, I want a banana, and so on. And this just shows, you know, that there's no discontinuity between species. That is the hill they have to die on. There's good evidence that there is discontinuity ontological discontinuity between species, and there's really no strong scientific support for this gradualism. You'll see this in the film as well. But see, that the reason I read that is Paul, in talking about the future, the glorified state, also goes back to creation. God created things differently. Different structures, different ontologies, different essences, you see. And the idea of an abiding essence is in contradiction to a Darwinian worldview. Things are always in flux. They're always changing, evolving. There are no fixed essences, you see. So, and there's, of course, contradiction in terms of who are you as a human being? Do you have an immaterial soul? Are you entirely physical? That's a point of conflict, see. So basically, live dangerously. The Bible does make certain claims about the natural world, that God had something to do with it. I'm not going to go through all the arguments about young earth and old earth. I agree with J.P. Moreland. I'm not a young earth person. I don't think the Bible requires us to believe it. I don't think the evidence fits it very well either. But the scripture certainly indicates God created the world out of nothing. He created each thing according to his kind in discontinuous actions. So theistic evolution doesn't really seem to fit the biblical narrative, even though the biblical narrative is not written as technical science. Even if it's written poetically, that does not mean it fails to make a scientific claim. Think about that. People say, oh, it's poetry, it can't be propositional. Bunk. It's poetry, it can't have any scientific merit. Bunk. I mean, something can be poetic and describe objective states of affairs, just not in scientific detail. So it seems to me that you've got God acting in discrete periods. How long those periods were, I think, is really pretty much an open question. But he's intervening here, intervening, each thing according to its kind. Now, does kind perfectly correlate to how science understands species today? Maybe not. But there's still this idea of some kind of a fixed ontology that God has created, which was not left up to time and space and chance and natural law. Okay. Now, the way things have been set up is that we assume naturalism, and we assume that religion has nothing positive to contribute to the discussion of life on earth. Now, and we also assume that there is no strong empirical or theoretical reason to question the basic model of Darwinism. Basic model that entities produce offspring that are varied, and the ones that have beneficial attributes survive and continue to thrive and propagate, and the others tend to die off. The idea is something like that has to be true. There's no design in it whatsoever. It's not Lamarckianism, right? It's not that the environment changes their structure. It's that their structure changes internally through mutations, and some mutations are beneficial and some are not. Something like that, according to naturalism, has to be true. Period. The alternative is, heaven forbid, God or some kind of intelligence.